Hello, this is episode number 21 of Tech Policy Weekly from the Technology Liberation Front for Thursday, July 19, 2007. I'm your host, Adam Theater of the Progress and Freedom Foundation. On this week's show, we're going to be focusing on the contentious battle of the auction of the 700 MHz spectrum and the debate about whether or not open access or net neutrality-like restrictions or mandates should be applied to at least a portion of that spectrum. Joining us this week to discuss this issue are my fellow Technology Liberation Front contributors, Hans Haney of the Discovery Institute. Hi, Hans.
Hey, Adam.
James Gattuso of the Heritage Foundation. Jerry Brito of the Mercatus Center. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, Adam.
And Tim Lee of the Cato Institute. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
Hans, I'm going to begin with you and ask you to give us some basic background about what's going on here and why this fight about this particular patch of spectrum is so important. So go ahead and do that for us.
Well, Adam, right now the FCC is writing the rules that will govern the new licenses and spectrum, which is now occupied by television broadcasters and TV channels 52 through 69. And this is referred to a portion, this is a portion of the 700 megahertz band. And this spectrum is going to be available for public safety and commercial wireless services after February 17, 2009, as a result of the digital television transition. Now, back in 1993, Congress told the FCC to use auctions to award licenses and valuable spectrum to the highest bidders. Prior to that, the FCC used a green approach in which applicants hired lawyers, engineers, and lobbyists to prepare applications to try to influence the commission and to occasionally or frequently litigate the results. Auctions have eliminated a lot of wasteful lawyering and lobbying and have reaped billions of dollars for the Treasury. The FCC has stated and repeatedly stuck to the principle that auctions are for the purpose of ensuring that the spectrum licenses are assigned to those who place the highest value on the resource and will be suited to put the licenses to the most efficient use. Now, recently, Google and others have come forward, and Google in particular has claimed that incumbent wireless carriers are likely to prevail in a spectrum auction when they compete head-on with a potential new entrant like Google because, quote, the spectrum simply has more economic value and overall usefulness to incumbents like Verizon or AT&T than to a would-be new entrant like Google, unquote. And so Overall and many allies are proposing, in effect, to devalue the spectrum, or at least to make it less valuable to Verizon and AT&T. First, they want the FCC to force the successful bidder to adopt open access policies on any licensed spectrum it holds. They want this to mean that consumers can use any device or application. Third-party service providers can resell the successful bidder's wireless services, and the successful bidder will provide wholesale network capacity on a non-discriminatory basis. Now, earlier this week in an interview with Leslie Cawley of USA Today, FCC Chairman Kevin Martin stated whoever wins this spectrum, if he has his way, will have to provide truly open broadband network, one that will open the door to a lot of innovative services for customers. That would mean you can use any wireless device and download any mobile broadband application with no restrictions, Martin explained. The details of what the 5F is actually considering at this moment are a bit sketchy, but a statement issued by AT&T today states that it believes the draft order would simply take one block of the upper 700 megahertz band being auctioned to allow an experiment with an alternative open device, open applications business model of the type proposed by Google and others, and that the proposal doesn't mandate a wholesale business model in any particular block, nor does it mandate net neutrality style regulation on the other commercial spectrum being auctioned. Also, AT&T claims there would be a reserve requirement to ensure no one is able to obtain any spectrum without paying an appropriate price to the Treasury. And if bids for this particular spectrum don't meet the reserve requirement, or if no qualified bidder comes forward, the block would be withdrawn and re-auctioned without the open device, open applications requirement. Now, these rules, which are under discussion, are due to come out at the end of this month.
Good. Thank you, Hans. I'm going to turn to James first. James, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what the problem might be with essentially tinkering with an auction like this, and is this unprecedented, or has there been efforts before to essentially rig auctions and have special requirements or rules imposed on winning bidders?
It's certainly not the first time. In fact, this is the way the FCC allocated spectrum for the first 60 years of its existence. You know, remember, these frequencies we're talking about used to be UHF television frequencies. When they were first assigned to users, they were under very specific and detailed direction of what to use them for, UHF television. Then in the 1990s, there are two changes that the FCC undertook. One is to change the assignment mechanism, which had been lotteries and comparative hearings and things like that, to change that assignment mechanism to auctions. The highest bidder gets the spectrum. But the set related change, and in my mind the more important one, is to change the allocation, the definition of what you could use that for. So the FCC went to a system where it would have very, very flexible roles, essentially of allocating spectrum to whatever use the winning auction bidder has for it, as long as it does not interfere with others. That's the key to reform. That's the key that allowed spectrum to be used for the highest and best use possible. So what's happening here is the FCC is looking to go back a bit to the old style, looking at the market themselves and deciding for themselves what the spectrum should be used for. In this case, they're deciding it should be used for an open application, open device sort of system of the sort proposed by Google and other network neutrality advocates. That's a step backwards. It's going to be reduce the value of the spectrum and get services that aren't as consumer friendly.
Why don't you mention briefly how there was some essentially auction rigging in the mid-90s with a certain batch of spectrum and how that didn't turn out so well?
Well, that's right. Back in the mid-90s, there was an emphasis on you know, set-asides for small enterprises, for minority-owned enterprises, which some of that still goes on. And what had happened was one purportedly small enterprise, which had a lot of backing, as it turned out, called NextWave, won an auction and then, as it turned out, was not able to pay, didn't come up with the money. And what happened is the company litigated the auction, wanted to keep the spectrum, ended up keeping it because of quirks in bankruptcy law and how it applies to spectrum. But as a result of it, those frequencies went unused for years while this went through the court. I think we have a different situation here because as I understand the plan, there's not a specific set aside for any particular user, but all users have to have a certain type of service in mind. That being an open application, open device.
So guys, has there been any details about what the rules specifically would look like? I mean, is the winner of this auction, are they then going to have to go back to the FCC, and is the FCC going to tell them what to do, or are they going to have to submit a plan to the FCC that the FCC would have to sign off on, or what would the process be?
Well, normally, what the process is that's going on right now is that they're writing the actual license terms. Mm-hmm. And so as long as whatever they do complies with those license terms, it's fine.
Right. But
the problem
is... But, I mean, what would the substance of those license terms be? I mean, what
well, we don't know. And that's,
okay.
That's part of the problem is that we, you know, we're sort of guessing right now because you know, the FCC, through Kevin Martin's and other grapevine sort of rumors, we're sort of getting an idea of what's going to happen. We don't know exactly yet.
Yeah. The two sources of information I have, at least, are statements in the media by the chairman and this letter by AT&T that just came out earlier today. And those list two requirements. They're could be many more, but first the requirement that whatever system, broadband system, is put on these frequencies, that they be that they work with any existing handset or handset system, any manufacturer's handset, and secondly that any application, broadband application, be allowed to operate on the system.
Well, let me jump in on that point and ask Jerry Brito to basically comment on this, and let me play devil's advocate, Jerry, and ask, what's wrong with that? Because this is something you've been arguing with others like Professor Tim Wu of Columbia and others who proposed the idea of so-called neutrality for wireless or Carter phone for wireless, and I know you've been engaged in debate with them about that issue. Tell us what you fear would be come out of this if these rules were applied.
Well, I mean, what Carter phone refers to is a decision that was levied by the FCC when Ma Bell, when AT&T was the only network, well, the only phone network, and it was a monopoly, and that would only allow certain applications, certain devices to be attached to its network. And FCC, through this Carter phone decision, allowed any device to be attached. And that was a boon that gave us all sorts of new innovation. The difference here, and that's basic issue that I take, is the assumption that we don't have competition in today's market, wireless market. So we don't really need a Carter phone for wireless because there's competition in the wireless market. And you know, Tim Wu and others will say, well, it's not really the number of competitors that matters. If you look at the outcomes, right now you can buy an unlocked phone and you can take it to any carrier and it'll work. And you can, even if you subscribe to a carrier that sells you a locked phone, you can in many cases get it unlocked by the carrier once your contract is up. And whenever your contract is up, you can, you know, shop around and get a different deal with different applications that you can use and whatnot.
Look, Jerry, let me ask you, the proponents of this sort of regulation point to many phones on the market and say, look, there are certain types of applications or services that consumers cannot access, or they can't break out of a contract, or look at this damned iPhone, I can't access it on any network of my choice. I mean, what do you say to critics like that? Because I think you're an iPhone owner, are you not?
Yeah, I sure am. But that doesn't mean that there isn't competition, right? I mean, the iPhone is a terrific device. It's got a real browser, and no other phone has that. How are we able to get this innovation if there isn't any competition?
The other thing that I find kind of problematic about this is that it's just not possible to say that any device and any network should be compatible. Because, you know, if I go down to my basement and I develop some new type of device, you know, I can't just go to AT&T and say, okay, you have to now support this. So somebody's going to have to make a decision about, you know, what protocols the device is going to use, the network's going to use, and, you know, what the requirements are to have a connection to it. And, yeah, I think there's a good argument that it would be better if those protocols were more rather than less open. But there's still, at some level, there's going to be somebody who's going to have to decide, you know, what capabilities the network is going to have, and inevitably, whatever decision is made about that, it's going to shut some people out and give other people advantages. And so I think it's troubling that people would jump on this rule in the abstract without knowing any details about what the actual rule is going to look like.
There's another question too. That's a good point, Tim. And another side to it that I've been thinking about is, yeah, I've seen advocates of this plan, Vegas it is, I've seen advocates of this plan say one of the great benefits is that you'll be able to take your iPhone and use it on any wireless network. And that assumes that it's the wireless networks that are stopping the iPhone from being usable everywhere, and I'm not so sure that's the case. I think it's Apple that equally wanted the relationship with AT&T for either you know system reliability or good technical reasons or just a business partnership. But it's Apple itself that wanted to ensure that there is a relationship with AT&T. And I can't imagine these rules are going to apply to the manufacturer, force them to make their systems available.
Apple, the deal that Apple struck with AT&T, which gives AT&T a 5-year exclusivity over the iPhone, which is unprecedented from any other device, Apple gets a cut of every iPhone subscription. And so I think that's part of the deal that they made. And you know, it worked out for them great. And you know,
now,
it could have gone to any
other. Gary, let me ask you a question. A point you made earlier when you wrote about this on the tech liberation front is that a lot of phones aren't like the Apple iPhone at all, but they're different. They're a little bit less sophisticated, but still they have a lot of stuff in them. But they are reasonably priced because essentially they are cross-subsidized, correct? So what would the impact be of various types of open access / net neutrality or Carter phone type rules on wireless on the actual cost of some of these handsets that in all actuality I believe cost hundreds of dollars more in some cases than what we pay for them?
Well, a good example of that is the Motorola Razr when it first came out, and that was like a $500 phone at retail, you know, at no subsidy. But you could go to AT&T, and if you sign up for a 2-year contract, you could get it for $99, and it would be an incentive for you to go and sign up with AT&T or whatever carrier. If you can't offer those sorts of incentives, your handset is going to be $500. Now, somebody like Tim Wu will say, well, you're just postponing the payment. You are signing up for a 2-year contract, and so you're going to pay back at least a portion, if not all, because, I mean, AT&T is not going to give you anything for free. You're going to be paying that back over 2 years. And he will say, you know, well, consumers might like to have now and pay later sort of deal, but that's not really that really isn't a difference there. But I'm sorry, but there is a difference. If consumers like that, that's a choice they should have. Right now I have a choice. I can take that. I can take an incentive for a two-year contract, or I can go out and buy an unlocked phone and go to any of the carriers and sign up with no contract. With the open access, with the net neutrality sort of regime, you wouldn't have that choice at all. You would only have the choice of buying an unlocked phone and paying that.
Okay, Hans and James, could you maybe talk to us a little bit more about the politics of this, about where this moves next, who might be likely to support it, who else on the commission that is, and what's also happening in Congress?
Yeah, Adam, I mean, certainly, as we all know, net neutrality has been a hot issue in Washington, D.C., particularly in Congress. The FCC is currently conducting a notice of inquiry, and it's just received reply comments. And the Federal Trade Commission has just come out with a major study as a broad-based hearings that it held on the issue. So this is a very major topic, and, you know, one thing that Kevin, the chairman of the FCC, could be thinking here is that this proposal might be a way to experiment and basically contain the damage if there is any. And if it's successful, then, you know, obviously then it would, you know, be something that others would point to and advocate that it be expanded in the future. He may feel that this, this is a way to do that without, and that might be preferable to, you know, having Congress or the FCC do something on a more industry-wide basis that could have, you know, seriously bad and extensive consequences if it's a failure, like, you know, I suspect it would be.
Hans, do you think the votes are there on the commission for something like what Kevin has proposed? It seems like if he wants it, he can get probably three votes on this, don't you think?
Yeah, I would suspect that's the case, Adam. We know that Commissioner Copps has objected that this proposal doesn't go far enough. And there are a number of public interest consumer advocacy groups who are making the same point. And so they want a wholesale and resale access requirement added at a minimum. And then, of course, they'd like it to apply to all of the spectrum held by the successful bidder. It's difficult to imagine how the commission could ever adopt something. There are three Republican votes, and it's difficult to imagine how the commission could ever swallow something like that. I would suspect that this would pass. I would suspect that Commissioners Copps and Adelstein would realize that this is about the most that they could get, and that they can't get it. They want it.
I tend to agree with that. Now, there's some caveats. Just today, there's a report that Google and Skype FCC, that the plan needs to go farther, that it doesn't go far enough into net neutrality. So rather than accepting this proposal and saying we got quite a bit of what we wanted, they're pushing for more. So does that mean that the Copps and Adelstein will hold back their crucial votes for this plan? And if they hold back their votes, or if Chairman Martin increases the amount of regulation here in order to woo their votes, does he give up in terms of a conservative Republican opposition? Another factor we haven't mentioned is that there's been a lot of outside interest in this from Capitol Hill, especially Republicans in Capitol Hill, and a lot of the conservative and free market organizations, many of whom 2 years ago would not have been interested or understood this issue at all. But people have been talking net neutrality for 2 years now. They've been engaged in it, and they see this as net neutrality. So that's a constituency that has to be addressed. It's a difficult path for Kevin Martin to thread, and right now his plan looks regulatory, so it's probably a good thing it's a difficult path.
You know, AT&T, as we know, has already sort of expressed some sort of acceptance for this sort of compromise. I'm curious about Google. And, James, you know, you're saying how their sort of, I guess, their first signals that today is that they still want the FCC to go further. But I'm curious how serious they are about actually bidding in this auction. Is this enough? Will this devalue, as it were, the spectrum enough that they would get in? Is it not enough? Do they need to hold resale and wholesale in order to get into this auction? Are they serious at all about actually becoming a wireless carrier? It's very interesting.
Is that the expectation that Google would I know there's been speculation that Google might get in this auction, but it really doesn't seem like they, you know, they've never really been an infrastructure company, and I don't think they're going to want to hire, you know, the 10,000 people or whatever it would take to build out a network. Does anybody seriously expect they would enter this market?
Well, I mean, they have held out the possibility. and they continue to hold out the possibility in their filings at the FCC. So they say every time that they use themselves as an example of a bidder, and they are careful to say that they may or they may not do it. Now, they have talked about how they lack experience. They lack an embedded network with towers and backhaul and all the other stuff, customer relations and advertising, and they lack the kind of cash flow that AT&T and Verizon have. But, of course, they could hire, they could buy all of that. We all know they could buy anything that they needed. And so it's kind of an open question. But the other point I just want to make is that Google can voluntarily do the other things, the other things I've talked about, the wholesale, the resale, public interest gadflies are advocating here. Google can do those things if they want. And if Google really believes that their vision is the correct vision and ultimately the most profitable and the most valuable to society, if they really believe that, maybe they'll do it.
Right. It's just a question of whether they can, quote-unquote, devalue spectrum enough politically so they're able to bid on it. And to answer Tim's question, Google has flirted with providing infrastructure. They're providing Wi-Fi in San Francisco and in wherever it is that their headquarters is at, that city in California. Mountain View, thank you.
Remember also that Google is pushing specifically here. One of their major requests of Kevin Martin is to add on a requirement of wholesale unbundling for the spectrum, wholesale leasing of the spectrum that's won at auction. Google would not have to be a bidder at auction. They could simply, once that wholesale requirement's in place, they could sit back and take at least on a wholesale basis small parts of spectrum for small systems, larger parts. They could set up a virtual system that they have a lot of options to jump in at any point that they want and probably at discounted FCC set rates.
But this discounting of the spectrum or devaluing of the spectrum, at some point, doesn't that capture the attention and the concern of members of Congress who have already paid for future budget deficit holes with the spectrum money several times over?
Not if Kevin Martin seems to be pretty shrewd by having these reserve prices in what AT&T is saying is his plan. If you have those reserve prices that at least meet the bottom end of the estimation of what this is going to bring in, it might in Congress. And I was going to say also that, going to the idea of Google as a bidder, if I was in Google's shoes and I could get the price down low enough, I would bid on it. No matter what, because you just want, this is really, really juicy spectrum here, really valuable stuff. It's Manhattan real estate, and if you can just get your hands on it, the government isn't going to let you fail once you have your hands on it. So you can come back and ask for an amendment to your license and say, you know what, we tried this and it didn't really work, so we just wanted you to tweak the license a certain way.
That's a really good point. The commission routinely grants waivers for everything, and they could get excused from any one of these requirements if they came back and said they gave it their best effort and it didn't work.
Okay, good. Is there any other angle we've missed here, guys? I know there's ongoing questions about public safety spectrum issues and things like that. Jerry, did you want to mention something in that regard?
Yeah, what's interesting about this is, so there's 84 megahertz total changing hands here. 60 of those are going to be auctioned. 24 are going to public safety directly. Now, apart from those 24, Frontline Wireless had been petitioning for rules to be set for 10 megahertz adjacent to the 24 that go to public safety to have sort of a quasi-public safety license where a private bidder could purchase them, have open access requirements over them, but then be able to operate over that 10 plus an adjacent 12, so a total of 22, and it's kind of complicated. And it seems like the Martin plan, from press accounts and whatnot, isn't going the whole frontline way. What the Martin plan seems to be doing is it's leaving the 24 for public safety the way they are, and it is granting an additional 10, which, again, I personally, you can read what I've written on Tech Liberation, it's just a bad idea to assign more spectrum because more spectrum is not what public safety needs. But he would take 10 megahertz at auction that would go to a winning bidder who would then have an obligation to build a network over which public would be good enough for public safety to use. Now, this really, again, sort of does this devalue that spectrum enough for Frontline to get in there? Frontline's a startup. And what's interesting is that there are press accounts of Verizon now who has been opposed to this plan all along. Verizon being in talks with Public Safety to bid on that 10 megahertz and build a network. And, of course, they have infrastructure in place that they could leverage for this. So really fascinating how sort of Frontline's plan is coming back to bite them.
That's going to do it for Tech Policy Weekly this week. I want to thank Hans, James, Jerry, and Tim for joining me this week. And to read more commentary from the entire Technology Liberation Front gang, please visit us at techliberation.com. Also, if you'd like to comment about something we said here today on the show, you can post a comment on the website. Just go to techliberation.com/podcast, and you can leave a comment on the page for this specific show. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend. Please write a review of the show on iTunes, and don't forget to dig our podcast. Until next week, I'm Adam Thier. See you then.